I'm Ian, and I'm a priest.
I'm David. I'm an organist.
And this is All Things Right and Musical.
Welcome to this special episode of All Things Right and Musical. Our guest today is an associate professor of church music and director of chapel music at Virginia Theological Seminary. And her new book about the creators of the Hymnal 1982, Shapers of the Hymnal 1982, Our Faith in Words and Music. And we're delighted to welcome Dr. Marty Wheeler Burnett. Marty, welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So we always like to ask our guests on this podcast, what is your earliest memory of Episcopal liturgy?
I grew up in the United Methodist Church, so my earliest memory of Episcopal liturgy comes from college years. My organ teacher at college, Dr. Clyde Holloway, was the organist and choirmaster at Christ Church Cathedral in Houston, Texas. And we were invited down there on many occasions as students to turn pages or sing in the choir, to do various things, and to attend church. And that was where I first experienced the Episcopal Church. The Methodist Church, where I grew up, was fairly traditional in terms of music and liturgy. When I got to college, I found that the Episcopal Church really felt like coming home. I was very comfortable with the worship there, and of course, there was wonderful music, and that drew me to the Episcopal Church.
What was the climate and the culture in the Episcopal Church like leading up to the decision to create the Hymnal 1982? And in particular, how is it, in what ways has it changed over the last 40 years or so?
40 years, it's hard to imagine, isn't it? I remember all of these times when I was a young person and in college years, when all of this was going on. There was a great deal of excitement at that time about the 1979 Book of Common Prayer and the liturgical renewal movement. I remember particularly the amount of diocesan involvement. Each diocese had a very active liturgy and music commission. There was a national organization, the Association of Diocesan Liturgy and Music Commissions, that was very involved in providing materials and in offering annual conferences for training. This period, as you know, is referred to in our hymnal as the hymn explosion, to quote from the preface to the hymnal, a worldwide outburst of creative liturgical and musical activity of a magnitude unparalleled since the Reformation. There was a real awareness at this time in the church's history that we were part of, as the hymnal calls it, a changed and changing world that was leading to a need for new hymnody. And one of the unique things about this book is that it brought in new sources that had not been a part of hymnals in the past, traditional spirituals, even more of them, early American folk tunes, and the first forays into global hymnody, which was a trend that came a little bit later after this book, but we see the first examples of that in this time. So I think that the level of excitement about church music and the creative outburst, the outpouring of composition and poetic expression made it a unique period in our church's history.
So, Marty, who are some of the major figures involved in the creation of the Hymnal 1982?
Well, there are a number of names that are very familiar to us and some that are less familiar. There's a list in the preface of the hymnal, and before I mention a few, I'd like to share the list with your listeners. So many important people who gave years and years of their lives in the volunteer effort of putting this book together. Jeffrey Butcher, Charles J. Child, Jr., Robert H. Cochran, Elizabeth Morris Downey, Carol Morey Foster, Raymond F. Glover, Jerry D. Godwin, Eric S. Greenwood, William M. Hale, Marion J. Hatchett, David J. Hurd, Jr., Roy F. Keel, James H. Litton, Richard T. Prue, Arthur Ray, Walter C. Ryder, Russell Schultz Widmar, Frederick P. Williams, and Alec Whiten. And then some important consultants who contributed the book: Carl P. Daw, Jr., Georgia M. Joyner, Marilyn J. Kaiser, Anne K. LaCroix, J. Wary McCready, James McGregor, Bruce Neswick, Charles P. Price, McNeil Robinson II, F. Bland Tucker, and John E. Williams, Jr. What I set out to do in this project was to interview all the living members of the hymnal committee. And these were the ones who were still with us at the time I started the project, and I was able to interview them. Jeffrey Butcher, Elizabeth Morris Downey, Carol Morey Foster, Jerry D. Godwin, David Hurd, Russell Schultz, and consultants Carl Daw, Marilyn Kaiser, J. Wary McCready, Bruce Neswick, and John Williams. At the time I was working on this project, I was not able to interview James Litton, who was so important to this project, the editor of the service music in the hymnal. He was not able to do an interview, and he subsequently passed away. But James Litton kept amazing notes, and they are all in the Episcopal Church archives. So I was able to go to the archives and do research and read his extensive notes from the entire hymnal process. That was very informative, and those notes allowed his voice to be heard as part of this book.
One of the things that's so fascinating for me is hearing you read that list of names is that I actually find that I have met or interacted with some number of them. And so it's exciting that, you know, this book is such a giant in our history, and these giants still walk among us. Was it people who received the hymnal in real time in 1985 when it reached the pews? Probably, you know, most of them did not know these people. How was the hymnal received by the kind of rank and file membership in Episcopal churches?
All things considered, I think it was well received and widely accepted. One of the unique things about this book is how widely accepted it was. Most parishes ended up purchasing copies of this book and incorporating it into their worship right away. The introduction of the hymnal was prepared through an intensive period of education, which included workshops all around the country, a published hymnal sampler, and active work in every diocese by the Diocesan Liturgy and Music Commissions. This all contributed to the hymnal being widely used and widely accepted, and I think was quite successful.
So I also loved hearing all these stories about and from these giants that David referenced, the giants of Episcopal hymnody. You know, one of the things that I regularly hear about prayer book and hymnal revision is that we don't have figures like that today. What do you make of that notion that we lack that kind of those kinds of giants as a reasoning for not engaging in prayer book or hymnal revision?
Well, I have an interesting story to share about that from my colleague William Bradley Roberts, who's the professor emeritus of church music here at Virginia Theological Seminary. Bill Roberts talks about his conversations with Ray Glover when Ray was still living, and Ray Glover often made the statement, "There were giants in those days. There were giants in those days." And Bill responded to him, "Yes, and in many cases you helped to create those giants by giving them a task of great importance." I think there are plenty of talented people in the church today who, given the chance, would be able to do marvelous things in terms of hymnal revision, creating new materials, new music for us to use in our liturgies. I think providing the opportunity and the platform to do so can help to create giants in a new generation.
If there was one thing, maybe, what was one thing that surprised you as you conducted these interviews and discussions?
I think the thing that surprised me the most was the sense of closeness and community, even these 40 years later. This committee was close like a family. That's the word they used to describe their relationship. In almost every case, we were like a family. Their commitment to the creation of a new hymnal and whatever that took, Carol Foster used those words specifically, whatever it took to get the job done, it involved years of intensive work. Volunteer work, away from churches and jobs and families, but yet that closeness and that willingness to work together created this strong community. It's a process that was different from any future process, I think, in the age of Zoom and email, things that they didn't have in those days. But the time spent together created a strong community that I think influenced the shape of the book.
The last part of your book deals with the strengths and weaknesses of the hymnal 1982 moving forward. If you personally could change anything about the hymnal 1982, what would it be based on your own research and experience with the book?
I think one of the most important things is that we need to move to a complete digital package that will support church music today. Things like downloadable graphics for church bulletins, recordings that musicians can use to listen and practice, copyright permissions for reprinting, projecting, streaming. In other words, a one-stop shop that will make work easier, especially when so many of our congregations are small congregations with part-time or bivocational clergy and musicians. Making these materials easily available through church publishing is, I think, the next step in terms of addressing the book, which is a wonderful resource, and I want to see us keep a hymnal in the pews if at all possible, but to make all the other resources available to make the work for clergy and church musicians easier.
As a practicing church musician, I have to say I agree with that 100%.
In the interviews I did with church musicians, this was the number one thing that was mentioned, giving us the resources that we need to do our jobs more effectively and more easily.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Marty, one of the shortcomings or things that musicians would like to see that you identified from these interviews in the book is service music, additional service music settings, including a cappella or potentially a cappella service music settings, which often means something that's a little bit easier to sing. And that really resonated with me, especially having served in parishes where service music feels harder for people or less familiar. Even once you get used to it, it can often feel for some less joyful than certain hymns. So my question is, what would you say to average Episcopal parishioners who love or at least appreciate the importance of some of those service music texts like the Sanctus, while also finding, or the Gloria, for example, while also finding them difficult to sing or less joyful, in part because they're not metric, in part because they might have relatively unique musical settings that it's just harder to get sort of used to?
I think a lot of the service music in our hymnal can be challenging, especially for small congregations, and especially when there may not be an organist or a trained organist in the parish. They might be using other instruments or, as you mentioned, singing a cappella. As we look at the supplements that have been published since the hymnal 1982, we certainly have a wider range of service music settings and a wider variety of styles of music. And many of these are very accessible based on folk tunes or other materials. There's also on Rite Song now a collection of service music that's available for download. It's a digital collection that was commissioned and gathered by the Association of Anglican Musicians. So there are a lot of good resources out there, and I think this is an area where we need to even create more resources, things that are accessible in a variety of styles and that are appropriate for different contexts. I've found in my work that most congregations are capable of learning 3 to 4 settings of service music, of mass settings, so that they can vary them seasonally. It requires repetition and teaching, but this is something that's within the range of what most congregations can accomplish. So the key, I think, is choosing settings that are appropriate for your context, and then making a concerted effort to repeat and to teach, and that can equip the congregations to be able to sing the service, which a sung service was one of the premises of the Book of Common Prayer and the hymnal 1982, to be able to make this service music come alive for congregations by providing them options.
Kind of thinking about service music in the hymnal in particular, it just seems like such a huge task to choose a limited number of settings to print in a book like that going out to the whole church. and then knowing that any one congregation, like you say, could probably only successfully add three or four of them to their repertoire. What is the kind of verdict on how the Hymnal 1982 did the service music section overall? I know you reflected in your book a little bit about the differing opinion of the organization of that section, differing opinions. What's the verdict on how it went in the 1982, and in what ways do you think a future hymnal could improve on the service music section?
The Hymnal 1982 selection process ended up with a lot more service music than they could print in a book. And there were various interesting ideas that were considered, like a publication of a separate book that would have even more service music. That ended up becoming the appendix to the Hymnal 1982, which had reproducible settings of service music, among other things. But yes, it's hard to choose from so many different settings about what would be most useful in the wide variety of parishes that are served by this book. You know, the committee was looking to create a book that would be useful to small congregations, to larger congregations, cathedrals, schools, all kinds of different settings. And there's a limit to what you can put in one book. This is the reason why the digital resources we have now are so useful, in that finding music that's appropriate for the context is easier now. The challenge of that is, if we have so many materials, having the expertise and the skill to select what's going to work best. But I think a wealth of materials, that's a useful thing, to be able to explore different styles of music and choose what would be best in your particular setting, and for clergy and musicians to work together on making those choices. We have a great wealth of service music. There are lots of questions about how that service music section could be done better in a future hymnal. A number of people are concerned that it's hard to navigate when hymn number one is a fourth of the way into the book. The service music could perhaps be organized in a more user-friendly manner. But I think the important thing to keep in mind was, why did they choose to organize the service music section the way they did? And the reason why is that the service music was considered the first priority. That's why it's first in the book. It was considered to be important enough to give it that prominence. The idea that if you were going to sing anything in a service, it would be the service music, because those are the words for the liturgy. And then if you wanted to sing hymns as well, we have lots of hymns to choose from. But trying to elevate the idea of singing service music as primary, making it an important part and the primary part of what we would sing and prepare in a service. So keeping that in mind, I think it's helpful to understand the rationale behind the book and why it's organized the way it is. It wasn't random. It was done as an intentional choice to emphasize the primary importance of service music. And I think today, with the variety of kinds of liturgical settings we find in different churches and different places, it's good to have additional choices, but keeping in mind that service music is important. It's important to sing the service, and it's our responsibility as leaders of church music and liturgy to be able to choose things that are appropriate for our settings and to make even more materials available.
That's great. Thank you. I think that answer that you gave is so important, and kind of stressing the primacy that the committee wanted service music to have in Episcopal liturgy, I think is really important in understanding why the book ended up the way it did.
Mm-hmm. One of your interviews with David Hurd described the Hymnal 1982 as something of a snapshot in time. And I love that idea. It captures also how I feel about it. And it's such an evocative mental image, because whenever you have a snapshot in time, you can have real fondness for the memory, and there's always maybe just a tiny bit of cringe with it too, like, oh, did I really think that mustache was a good idea, or look at all that shag carpet. But with that in mind, that idea of the Hymnal 1982 as a snapshot in time, what are some of the ways that you think either fondly or not so fondly about that snapshot?
when you asked this question, I actually thought about Polaroids. Remember Polaroid photos? So I think that the snapshot of time is also a good image to keep in mind. This was a time of immense creativity and enthusiasm for church music. And as David Hurd mentioned, there was a greater consensus about what constituted the core of Episcopal church music, combined with a willingness to take risk by trying new things. In the book, I talk about some of the risky choices that they made, incorporating new and avant-garde music and text. There's a remarkable number of new hymns and tunes in this book, and I think that's significant in terms of this snapshot of history. And this willingness to include the full range of church music, from the earliest chants to the best of modern composers, a real appreciation for the breadth of the church's song, and attempt to capture that in the book. I think all of those are hallmarks of this particular snapshot in time. I think if we have another hymnal, it'll be a different snapshot, but I think we see in this book a wonderful image of the love and appreciation and enthusiasm for church music and an openness to new creation, which I hope will continue in any future hymnals that are created in our church.
Marty, thank you very much for your time today. It's wonderful to hear all these stories about the creation of the hymnal in 1982 that you've uncovered and documented for us, this really formational book in the life of our church that continues to mean so much to so many, myself included. This work really is a gift to the whole Episcopal Church, so thank you. The book is called Shapers of the Hymnal 1982, Our Faith in Words and Music.
Marty, I just want to add my thanks. One of the things, being a liturgy nerd, one of the things that I really enjoy is going back and understanding some of the thought process that lies behind the liturgies and new liturgical texts and things like that. And this book really is a profoundly important resource for those who come after that helps lend, give a little bit more background to all of what went into the creation of the hymnal 1982 in the words of its creators and those who are involved. So thank you so much for this. I really enjoyed reading it, and I really heartily recommend it.
Thank you so much, Ian and David. I've enjoyed working on this project so much. These people have made such a difference in my life and in the life of the church, and I've enjoyed interviewing the various people who were involved in the project and researching the archives and learning more about this profoundly influential hymnal. I wanted to mention that the book, Shapers of the Hymnal 1982, will be released on the day that marks the 40th anniversary that the first hymnals were shipped out to parishes in November of 1985. And when you think about this book, I'd like to encourage you to consider creating a study group in your choir or parish. There are discussion questions and hymns to sing following each chapter that allow you to conduct a book group or a study group that I think would be really enjoyable and educational for people in the parishes and in Episcopal church choirs. So I encourage you to take a look at that and consider how you might use this as we celebrate the important anniversary of our hymnal in 2025 and 2026.